We are taking Senate Bill 327 off of the agenda today. Its future is to be determined. And we will open a work session to start out on Senate Bill 331. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 331 is here today on work session. There was previous public testimony on January the 30th. Oregon presently divides most theft offenses by dollar value. First-degree theft, a Class C felony, applies for stolen items valued at or over $750. Second-degree theft, a Class A misdemeanor, applies for stolen items valued between $50 and $750. Third-degree theft, a Class C misdemeanor, applies for stolen items valued at less than $50. There's also aggravated first-degree theft, a Class B felony, which applies for stolen items in a single or aggregate transaction at $10,000 or higher. Retail merchants have recently reported organized thefts involving multiple persons, often these persons are associated with methamphetamine dealing, in which persons steal various items, such as batteries or baby formula, from stores with the purpose of later reselling these items at venues such as flea markets. The persons intentionally keep the value of the items stolen from a particular store at a particular day low at a misdemeanor level. The persons then would hit the same or different stores the following days or following weeks. Then all of the items are, as an aggregate, sold to the secondary market. Senate Bill 331 seeks to capture this conduct, and it creates a new crime of organized retail theft. It punishes it at the felony level. To be guilty of organized retail theft under the bill as originally written, you need the following elements. First of all, that the person stole merchandise, acting in concert with another. I'm sorry, let me start over. The person stole merchandise, two, from a mercantile establishment. Three, the person acted in concert with another person, and then either for the aggregate value of the merchandise within a 180-day period was $1,000, or five, the person intends to resell the merchandise. The Dash 3 Amendment is the focus of discussion today, and here's what the Dash 3 Amendment does. First of all, in terms of that fourth element, the aggregate value of the merchandise within a 180-day period, it changes it to 90-day period. And then in the original bill, it was the aggregate value of $1,000. In the Dash 3 amendment, it is $5,000. So the time frame from 180 days to 90 days, the dollar value goes from $1,000 up to $5,000. And then in addition, what the Dash 3 amendment does, it also places the crime of organized retail theft within Oregon's racketeering statute. And then it eliminates the requirement about the person having the intent to resell the merchandise. So the elements of organized retail theft, according to the Dash 3 amendments, are person steals merchandise from a mercantile establishment, person acted in concert with another person, and the aggregate value of the merchandise within a 90-day period is $5,000. And I'll note then one last thing. There was a work group that formed after the initial hearing on this bill. These amendments were, many of them, suggested by Senator Prezonsky. It would not be accurate for me to say there was complete consensus among everybody as to all of these amendments. But nonetheless, that's the Dash 3.
Okay. And the whole purpose of this bill is to find some way to deal with these people, which is more serious than shoplifting, but somewhere short of RICO. Is that correct, Council?
Yes, Chair Burdick.
Okay. The questions of counsel from the committee. The Dash 3 amendments take out the intent with a shorter time period and a higher monetary threshold. The philosophy of the Dash 3 is that should be a standalone to prosecute under this provision. Any comments or questions from the committee?
There you go.
What do you think, Senator Beyer?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 331.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 3 amendments into Senate Bill 331. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 331 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 331 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Just a question. I wonder if fiscal has been issued on the Dash 3s yet.
It has not.
There is no fiscal ready, or there is no fiscal?
There is no fiscal ready.
We've had a lot of trouble getting fiscals for no good reason, in my humble view. Let's just go for it.
Madam Chair, I guess if it's more than $50,000, the Senate President has the authority to grab the bill and send it to Ways and Means without us doing it.
Yeah, I'm sure he does and would use it. So Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 331 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
I appreciate all the hard work. Whenever you have that many amendments, you know there's been some conversation about it. And I pulled out my notes from the public hearing we had January 30th, and Mr. Floyd was testifying under Safeway's group of people, and he said, this isn't just Safeway's problem. It's a $30 billion in organized theft losses nationally. And I agree with him. It's not just Safeway's problem. It is a huge problem, and I think this bill goes a long way to try to stop it.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Any other comments or discussion? Okay, so ordered. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
You have to be more enthusiastic than that, or I'll give it to Senator Walker.
And then I can quote Mr. Floyd again.
Okay.
Just letting you all know I keep notes.
Yes, we all know that, Senator Walker. We've learned that the hard way, some of us. Okay. Now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 578, and we will discuss the amendments, change councils. Welcome, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Clinton. Senate Bill 578 comes to you from Senator Brown's and Senator Berger, excuse me. And you have before you the Dash 2 amendments. Madam Chair, members of the committee, they replace the Dash 1 and the Dash 3, and they also replace the bill. Let me basically go through them. Section 2, starting in Section 2. Section 2, subsection 1, the person commits a crime is subjecting another person to involuntary servitude in the first degree if the person knowingly and without lawful authority or forces attempts to force another person to engage in services by causing or threatening the death of serious physical harm, physical restraining, or threatening physical restraint. It's a Class B felony. Section 3, we have subjecting another to involuntary servitude in the second degree where the person knowingly without lawful authority abuses or threatens to abuse the law or legal process, destroying, concealing, removing, or confiscating or possessing or actually purported a passport immigration document of another person, threatening to report a person to a government agency for the purposes of arrest or deportation, threatening to collect an unlawful debt, or instilling in the other person a fear that the act will be withheld, that the act will be withheld from other person the necessities of life, including but not limited to lodging, food, and clothing. It's a Class C felony. Subsection 4 creates a crime of trafficking another person if the person knowingly recruits, entices, harbors, etc., transports another person, will be subject to involuntary servitude. That's a Class B felony. Section 5, Madam Chair, members of the committee, also creates this creates a part of a civil action that's also later in the bill as it relates to what economic damages are, for the purposes of restitution. And then Section 6 simply puts the bill within the Oregon Criminal Code for the purposes of its definition. Section 7 includes these offenses in RICO. And then and going way, way over to the back, Section 9 creates a civil cause of action for the victim of these crimes for both special and general damages, punitive damages. Section 10, this allows a person to assert the defense of duress if they are subject to human trafficking, duress or forced into committing crimes, they could raise this defense. You may remember from our first hearing, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we had discussions along these lines about making it an absolute defense. And this was a compromise that was worked out by a work group, which met a couple of weeks ago. And then you have the Section 11, which creates a task force on trafficking, by which the Attorney General of the Department of Justice shall provide the staff support for this task force. And I spoke with Renelle Schenkel earlier in the day, and they plan to absorb the cost of this. Then we go on beyond that to the last two sections, which the task force will be repealed January 2nd, 2009, and then Section 13, emergency clause.
Okay, and Council, it's my understanding we're looking at the Dash 2 amendments and not the Dash 3.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We're not looking at the Dash 3. That's included in the Dash 2, as is the Dash 1, with some modifications.
Got it.
To the Dash 1.
Okay. All right. This is the kind of bill that it's discouraging to think that we need in this country, but apparently we do. And it's a very compelling hearing, and I hope this bill will do some good. Senator Beyer, are there any questions from the committee? Senator Beyer, you're just here just in time to make a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 578.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 578. Is there any discussion? Senator Walker?
Well, it's interesting, Madam Chair, because I just edited my daughter's paper. She's in graduate school in international studies, and I just edited a paper over the weekend on human trafficking. And the UN is taking this seriously, and in a convention on transnational organized crime, they are cracking down on this sort of thing, and one of the issues that was in the paper was how individual states could be helpful. So I appreciate that Oregon is joining. I think there's about 20 or 30 states, 24 states who have a bill like this already. So I'm very pleased people have worked hard on this.
Okay, and I want to thank all the people for their hard work, and one of my constituents was actually in the middle of this discussion as well. So any more discussion on the Dash 2 amendments? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 578 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 578 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, I'm going to see if Senator Brown wants to carry this bill, mm-hmm. and if she doesn't, since you just are an expert because of your daughter's term paper, yeah. would you like to carry this bill?
Yeah, because I'm looking it up here on her email because I just edited it, and every year approximately 50,000 women and children are trafficked, and they smuggle folks for as high as $70,000 apiece. So I'd have some interesting facts to throw in. I'd be
delighted. Okay, Senator Walker will do a fabulous job of carrying this unless Senator Brown chooses to bump you.
It is also linked to terrorism, so.
Let's leave that open. Okay, so ordered. Now we have been joined by Senator Winters, which is just in perfect time for our next three bills here. I'm going to, for the convenience of Senator Winters, I'm going to open the public hearing on all three of these next bills, Senate Bill 843, Senate Bill 844, and Senate Bill 845. Welcome, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Members of the Committee. I have with me, if it's okay, members of the Blue Ribbon Task Force who helped me put together these bills.
If you would like them to join you, please invite them.
I would like them to join me.
And if another chair is needed, these are mobile chairs in Senate Judiciary. So just what I would ask you is anybody who speaks to identify themselves for the record and to make sure a microphone is pointing right at you. Thank you.
We'll start with Senate Bill 843. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for hearing the three bills.
Senator Winters, can you identify yourself?
I'm Senator Jackie Winters, representing District 10, which is Salem, Monmouth, Independence, and Almsville and Turner. I also, along with Senator Courtney, co-chair a task force that this body, it's the Meth Task Force, Blue Ribbon Task Force, that this body authorized in at the end of the 2005 legislative session for the purpose of bringing together members of the of Marion County in order to look at barriers, to try to identify solutions as a community to address the methamphetamine epidemic, recognizing that this body also had passed comprehensive legislation, which did a wonderful job, by the way, Madam Chair, you and your co-chair in the House, that addressed the ingredients, also provided tools for law enforcement community with which to not only apprehend but to make certain that we were actually putting people in jail. The result of that also, as you know, actually had a positive effect on reducing the number of small mom-and-pop methamphetamine cookers across the state. The task force in Marion County, in taking into consideration that issue, also recognized that we were seeing a rise in the number of larger labs and a rise in the number of individuals who were actually bringing drugs up I-5 from Mexico up to Canada. As we, in looking at that particular issue, a task force, and I have to give thanks to a strike force was developed to individuals in this community that included the business community, the some of our state agencies, and every level of law enforcement in order to go after what we consider the high-level drug dealers. And when you look at the bills that are before you today, and thanks to you and those members of the emergency board who actually granted us $100,000 and we raised $300,000 in this community in order to create the strike force. One of the members who is here with me this afternoon is under Sheriff Greg Olson with Marion County Sheriff's Department. And our objective is to make it extremely difficult, and when I say extremely difficult, I mean extremely difficult, for the major meth dealers and manufacturers to continue to have their practice in Oregon and particularly here in Marion County. The one bill that I, and as I talk about this, we cannot talk about apprehending the dealers without talking about its impact and implication on families. So two of the bills that are here are bills that relate directly to families or individuals who were incarcerated and who require substance abuse treatment after they are released. Senate Bill 843 is one of those bills where once a person is incarcerated, their benefits are terminated. When a person is released, however, there is the issue of us wanting to be sure that they're treated so that they can return back to the community and have assistance where we can get, be able to get them employed, be able to get them housing. And I'm going to turn the rest of this over to Commissioner Carlson, Janet Carlson, who has worked on this particular bill legislation for some time. We found that when we looked at barriers to individuals that are returning from the community, that treatment was one of those barriers that was there. The ability for the individual to return back to their communities and we tell them to go and to sin no more, and yet the treatment isn't available there for them. And even though at one time they were a part of our health system. And so with that, Janet, I'm sure you have others to add.
Well, thank you, Senator Anderson. Chair Burdick and members of the committee. I had the privilege of serving on the Blue Ribbon Task Force, and it really was an excellent experience for us to learn from each other and also to look at how we might better come up with strategies to address this. I'm Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. Sorry, those of us that should know to do this keep forgetting. So we threw some concepts out in the Blue Ribbon Task Force. One bill that's not scheduled today is Senate Bill 842, and it's kind of a package with 843, so I'll allude to it even though it's not one that you're addressing here in that wasn't noticed as part of this meeting. The concept was that last session, Senate Bill 913 passed, and from what I understand, and Under Sheriff Olson gave me these numbers, we spend somewhere between $5,000 to $7,000 on psychotropic medication a month in the Marion County Jail, and about $15,000 on all medications a month in the Marion County Jail. And part of the issue is that if someone is mentally ill, they become incarcerated. Now they're the county's responsibility, but first of all, they go in pretrial, so they're innocent until proven guilty. Then once they're out, they have to re-enroll in the Oregon Health Plan, and that takes several months. And so in those several months periods, they're not getting their medications, they can decline, and then they're back in jail because of whatever they do. So Senate Bill 913 was passed to address that, and from my understanding, DHS is still working on kind of the implementation methodology for that. We were interested in extending that to substance abuse. Same issue. You have parents who are involved in methamphetamine or whatever, their children are taken away from them, they're put in jail. Now when they get out, they have 2 or 3 months before when they're re-enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, so they don't get the help that they need, and then they're not able to get their children back. So that's really the concept behind both Senate Bill 842 and 843. 842 was more on the criminal side when they're incarcerated. 843 was more on the dependency side, and the way this concept came to be is that I've been working on a task group at Marion County on housing, affordable housing, and how do you get more housing opportunities for folks who are coming out of incarceration. As you probably know, there are some restrictions that HUD puts on, but the local level can put even more restrictions on. So we were working on that particular issue and came up with this idea that if someone's coming out of incarceration and they want to reunify with their family, we could continue to call them a family even though their children aren't with them, as long as they're making good progress to be reunified within that one-year period. And so that was really the concept behind Senate Bill 843, is that we would define family for the Oregon Health Plan such that you wouldn't be considered an individual, because the way they've structured the Oregon Health Plan, substance abuse treatment is not part of that benefit if you're an individual. It is a part of the benefit if you're on the plan where you have your children and you're a family. So those are the simple concepts. Now, what happened from there is that we sent those concepts to legal counsel because Senator Winters wasn't there to ride herd on it, I think, in the early part of the session. There was a little bit of confusion, and it got in kind of late. So when it came out, we knew that there were some flaws in these two bills, but we dropped them anyway because of the deadline, and then figured that we would work on it. So Pat O'Sullivan is here from DHS, and she's brought a number of staff that have been part of a work group. The amendments that you have before you are the product of that work group, and I just got those last week, and Senator Winters has seen those as well. I understand that Jonathan Thompson has sent those down to council to be drafted. Is that correct? But they're not out of council yet. So that is the story behind Senate Bill 842 and 843. And would you like me to talk about 845 now, or do you want to wait and talk about that later? Okay. So I'll conclude my testimony on those two bills there then.
Okay, and then you want to address the other one
after Senator Winters has a chance to give an introduction.
Let Senator Winters drive the train here.
So you're adding I might want to clear up one point on 842, because I think there was some confusion as on 842, that there was some concern as to whether or not 842 would actually impact the existing population group, which NAMI would be concerned about, and it does not. It does not take away at all from what we're currently doing. It just merely clarifies for this particular group so that we're able to serve them. And I will have a conversation to make certain that the new language that we've asked LC to draft clarifies those issues and the concerns that they may have had with respect to the definition of drug dependent.
Okay, to avoid confusion here, we're just having the hearing on
843.
Yeah.
However, if I just could add, according to DHS, on the work group, they're kind of a package. And so if 843 passes without 842 or vice versa, it affects the fiscal. But that may not be the concern of this committee. It may be the concern of Ways and Means. I'm not sure how that works.
You mean it would have a fiscal if one passes without the other, but it wouldn't have a fiscal if both passed?
There is a fiscal impact for 843 that's listed, mm-hmm. and 842 is listed as zero. But and Pat, maybe
well, let's stick with 843. Okay.
All right.
Senate Bill 844, which is the unitary assessment in methamphetamine prosecution bill, and this bill was actually proposed by our district attorney together with our sheriff, who are also a part of the Blue Ribbon Task Force. And it provides for if the crime of conviction is that violation, which is the delivery part of the crime, that the assessment to the criminal, when prosecuted, would be $500, and $1,000 if the crime of conviction I think that's the manufacturing piece.
Yes.
Is $1,000. One of the things I need to clarify, this does not take away from our current unitary assessment program. And I know that there were some concerns that possibly that it did, but also that the funds for this would go into treatment. In order to provide funds to treat the individuals who that had been affected by the dealers and the manufacturers who have preyed on our communities and who are reaping the financial benefit, if you will, from the revenues that they have received from selling and manufacturing these drugs. And I think that it's within it makes good sense that they should have to contribute to the treatment of individuals. We're stuck here. We're constantly talking about how we're going to treat mothers and how we're going to put families back together. And so when we discussed this at our task force meeting, we believe that they have we shouldn't let them off the hook. They're the scourge. They're the ones that actually have created major problems in our community that have devastated families. And that's the basis for this particular piece of legislation. And I'll let Undersheriff Greg Olson to make some comments and input on Senate Bill 844.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Greg Olson. I'm the Undersheriff of the Marion County Sheriff's Office. And I've been in law enforcement for over 30 years, and the impact that methamphetamine has had on our office and our operations is considerably more than any of the other previous drugs that we've been involved with, especially the strength of the methamphetamine that's coming through and the problems we have with treatment. And in all honesty, treatment, it works. It works very well, but sometimes it takes up to 9 months for them to get clean and get their lives back in order. And be able to do the right thing with their families. We really believe that we need to make it so it's not good business for them to deal and manufacture methamphetamine. And if it's costly for them to do it, then they're going to move their business. They're not going to come here. And that's the simple fact. I mean, anyone that runs a business, if it's cheaper to operate your business in Kaiser than it is in Salem, you're going to move your business to Kaiser. And that's what we see with these guys, is they're moving from California to Oregon because it's cheaper to do business here.
Senators, I'm Mike Ryan. I'm the Community Service Director for Professional Mortgage Corporation here in the Salem community. And I've had the opportunity to work with the methamphetamine strike force since its inception. And I have a couple of comments to share. One would be some paraphrasing, actually, from our district attorney. He wasn't able to be here, and he sends his apologies. He had a commitment. He couldn't be here. He sent along an email, and I'd like to just share his thoughts with you just real briefly. He believes, from his perspective, as the others that have already talked here, that the premise behind the bill is very, very simple, to make meth dealers and manufacturers pay for the damage that they cause. And part of that is also taking care of the treatment of the addiction itself caused by this toxin in the community. The district attorney also wanted to let you know that he has long supported the notion, anyway, or the approach of having a revenue source from the dealers. And as written, it really would not compete from his perspective at all with the victim restitution because it is a simple tag straight on the meth dealers and the manufacturers. It's a non-waivable assessment that's placed $500 and then $1,000 on the manufacturers. And again, he sends his apologies not being able to be here. Then the other point that I wanted to emphasize would be from a community perspective, the work that's gone on by the legislature, and you have played a real key in that, moving forward legislation on chemicals and precursors, really had a tremendous impact on our state in this area. But we and other communities have had a real fearful, domino that's happened as a result of that, and that is having some organized crime individuals and organized crime units literally move into the communities and take over the manufacture and distribution of methamphetamine. And we have been targeting now out of the strike force those mid-level dealers and manufacturers in a heavy-duty sense. And that is the direction and the targeting that's going on in our community right now out of the strike force that Senator Winters mentioned to you. This goes hand in hand with that, and we kind of see this as just another arrow in that quiver that we all like to have in our communities, where we can put an assessment in place and also then have some dollars that would, address some of those unforeseen consequences of all of this work. So with that, that concludes my comments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Just a question for, I assume you're moving on to the next bill now?
Yes, okay, Senate Bill 845.
Okay, before we go there, I guess, and maybe this is a question much for staff, and it's not on merit, I guess I'm just confused that 843 and 844 don't have subsequent referrals, because one appears that it will have a fiscal impact and the other a revenue impact. I mean, you're dealing with 844.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Cruz, that's usually a call of the Senate President's office to determine whether to put a prior referral on a bill, if, in fact, they have it.
So I should look to see who the chief sponsor of the bill is in this case, I suppose. Oh, okay. Well, I mean,
doesn't mean the committee couldn't send them there, especially.
Okay, I mean, you know, it's an increase in unitary assessment, which is a revenue impact to a degree, and I'm not quite understanding how we can require Department of Human Services to provide substance abuse.
There's no, I yield to staff, but I don't believe that it's the fee assessment is not a, I think, the what you consider revenue impact. It is an increase in if you send to Ways and Means, whoever would have to receive the dollars in their limitation.
Right.
The ability to make the assessment is already in statute. This simply adds, if you read the ORS, the ORS ability is already there. So, but I yield to staff for the technicality of it.
Mm-hmm. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Cruz, on my general recollection as it relates to the issue of a tax versus a fee, let me give an example. If you increase the fee for a fishing permit and you're using the money to enhance fishing stock, it's not considered a tax. Now, if you took that same money and used it for prisons, it would be a tax. Now, possibly here, and then the question there is whether the bill would have to start in the House, not the Senate. The question here is you're increasing the unitary assessment, and then you're going to be using the money for treatment purposes. Arguably, that would be similar to the first analogy of the fishing license and the enhancement of fishing stock, but that's something we can ask legislative councils
on. But aren't they going to need a spending limitation to...
Well, I think there's different questions. I mean, I see on both bills, the staff made a summary, on both bills there's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, yet clear bills both have a revenue, and one bill has a revenue impact, clearly. The other bill, 843, has a fiscal impact. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think we've got the complete information yet.
That's correct. Those are preliminary staff measure summaries.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, this is not talking against the bills, just making sure that they're tracking where they should. And I know this is a specific allocation in unitary assessment, but in my time in the building, every time anything's been done with unitary assessment, it's been done in ways and means, simply because they have the right to, or that's where you put the spending limit on for specific categories. But if there's a way to do that without...
Well, you know, I guess I would say 843 would be the bill, and according to the testimony provided, it had about a $10 million fiscal impact. I would think that bill would be going through Ways and Means if it moves out of this committee.
And the only reason I'm questioning at this point is because the SMSs don't show anything.
And that's Pardon?
The SMSs don't show anything as far as either fiscal or revenue, and which is the reason for my question.
Yep. Chairman, Commissioner Cruz, it takes a while for the fiscal impacts to get to us from legislative fiscal, particularly if they wait oftentimes to see whether a bill is going to be amended.
And we don't want it to be next year.
Anything else on 844 then?
No.
So move into 845?
We can move on to 845.
Okay, that's the winners.
8:45, and I will yield to. I still want to say Representative Janet Carlson, but Commissioner Janet Carlson, and it's the Center for Family Success, and that bill actually addresses the issue of building strong families and keeping families together. And it's, you know, I think most of us would agree that that's probably should be one of our highest priorities in our battle against meth. I was telling somebody it's kind of interesting that when I was in Children's Services Division a lot of years ago, and actually one of my projects was freeing children for permanent placement, which is, we know it now, as termination of parental rights, that part of that principle and theory was to work to make sure and to provide the tools to families and to keep families together before you actually began termination process. And this is another one that talks about keeping and working to keep families together, and particularly when we talk about families that are being reunited from our institutions. So with that, Janet, I would ask you to give the specific details.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. This bill's ready to go, and I'm really excited about Senate Bill 845 and appreciate the opportunity to have this hearing. This, again, came out of the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Methamphetamine. Marion County is the fifth largest county in Oregon, but our population of state prisoners and local inmates is the second largest in the state. We, in 2005, conducted a one-day snapshot of our Marion County jail, and out of those 442 inmates, we learned that 74% overall were methamphetamine users, but 89% of the females, the women, were methamphetamine users. And these are the mothers who are in jail because of their meth use. We also learned that there are five factors that influence success after incarceration, and those are education, employment, substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, and housing. And finally, we learned that 73% of the inmates are parents. In fact, in that one-day snapshot of 442 inmates, there were 774 children involved. And so that translates into tens of thousands of children in the state of Oregon that are affected by incarceration. We also know from the 2005 statistics that 1,558 children in Marion County in 2005 were victims of abuse and neglect. And we, from anecdotal reports from child welfare, the majority of those children are involved with substance abuse, and methamphetamine is primarily the substance that is involved. We had the opportunity last year to see the Center for Family Success in Portland in the St. John's area, and it's a fabulous place. If you haven't been there, I would recommend that you take a site visit up there. The program goals of the Center for Family Success there and the one that we're trying to create here in Salem, in Marion County, are to reduce adult recidivism, to increase family reunification, and to augment the social support systems for parents and their children. And so this Center for Family Success is like a one-stop shop where families can get all of those five elements that we talked about that are needed for future success all in one place. According to the research studies, improving the relationship between children and their incarcerated parents when it's in the best interest of the child is vital to preventing the intergenerational cycle of criminality. Children are less traumatized when they maintain a consistent relationship with their parent during incarceration. Likewise, incarcerated parents are better equipped to raise healthy and successful children in the long term if they maintain a relationship with their children, attend parenting classes during incarceration, and receive additional support following incarceration. That comes from the research. And a lot of folks think, well, if someone goes use a meth user, they go to jail or prison. You take the child away, that's the end of the story. Well, what we know is that over 90% of those children actually are reunited with their families at some point, and that children are the children of incarcerated parents are 5 to 6 times more likely to be incarcerated themselves later in life than the average population. In Marion County, we met with 25 organizations last summer, and we're negotiating. In fact, Guido Calderazzo was working on negotiating agreements with each to start our Center for Family Success. And I'll just hit some high points. You have the detail in the handout, the yellow handout that is before you. The parent education and support, there's a parenting inside-out curriculum that will be offered there, and Sharon Darcy and Cindy Duran are here to talk about how that works in Portland. We've also talked to Salem Alliance Church, Parents Anonymous, the host program for Northwest Human Services that all provide parenting programs and are willing to help at the center. We're recruiting mentors to walk beside each family as they turn away from their addictions and the accompanying lifestyle. Our juvenile department's willing to have the kids do community service with landscaping, office work, and internships. For housing, we've forged relationships with both the Marion County and the Salem Housing Authorities, and families there will get help at the center from filling out the application forms and then demonstrating their qualifications for the program. The Community Action Agency will assist with ready-to-rent classes, tenant-based assistance, interview closets at their area resource centers for the clients. We've worked with Chemeketa, and they're going to provide the career software. It's called iMatch in the labor exchange system, so we can run it on our computers right on site, and they'll assist with GED and literacy and basic education, other kinds of education barriers. The Department of Human Services has offered to have a person drop in on site and help with self-sufficiency issues, food stamps, employment-related daycare, health care, job services, and so on. For early childhood development, Family Building Blocks, our relief nursery, is going to closely coordinate with the Center for Family Success. And Even Start is interested in having literacy mentors and literacy activities at the center. For school-age children, the Salem-Keizer School District is going to work to develop referral protocols for youth to connect the youth at the center with school district programs. Stand for Children is going to help us with their pro bono dental care program and with nutrition education and promotion of family involvement. We've also been working with Bridgeway Cascadia, Catholic Community Services, and the Marion County Health Department on substance abuse treatment and mental health treatment, and we are forging a relationship with the Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service for domestic violence safety planning, on-site consultations, support groups, and access to the hotline information. And then NAMI is going to offer educational presentations and opportunities to support clients with mental illness and their families. And then finally, for the district attorney and the courts and law enforcement, we've met with the Marion County Sheriff's Office and with others that are involved, with the judges, actually, on those coordinated protocols. So, for example, if center clients on parole or probation fail to show for their programs, there'd be a consequence for that. communication, release of information agreements, cross-training on topics such as criminal personality, motivational interviewing, personal safety, referral processes for parents involved with dependency or drug courts, and designating the Center for Family Success as a supported probation option for the court. So we have a place that we've located thanks to Salem Alliance Church. We have all the services lined up and are formalizing those agreements. All we need is a coordinator, and we're working on community fundraising for that. We believe that through this bill, if there's an endorsement from the state legislature for statewide replication, that that will help us with our funders to let them know that this is a model that is endorsed to roll out statewide and to try to stop that intergenerational cycle of criminality that I mentioned earlier. And then by having state agencies provide technical assistance, it can help with quality issues, evidence-based practices, and sustainable funding. Finally, it does mention several state agencies working together in the last part of the bill. Partners for Children and Families is already in place through the governor's executive order, and those agencies are actually part of that. And Pat Pittman is here from the State Commission on Children and Families if you have questions on how that works. So I want to thank you and appreciate your support on Senate Bill 845.
In closing, I would just like to add, you directed us, actually, in 05, when we convened the task force, to target better use of resources to battle the methamphetamine epidemic. You directed the task force to look at ways that what we were doing here in Marin County that could be replicated in other places across the state. Today you have before you three of the four bills that actually we believe that does what you directed us to do in 05. And there are other issues that we're working on, but it's the first of the kind effort that I think that's been made to increase coordination between all levels of government. As you heard from Commissioner Carlson, we did not leave out anyone in working on this and these issues. It included government, the private sector, anyone that we believe that had any resources, we brought them to the table. And I just want to thank you for considering the legislation. We think that it will help us in the future to make a further dent in the meth epidemic. I know that you feel like I do that this is one subject that we all would like to eradicate and not have to talk about it again in the future. And it's also one that we also recognize and we know that the impact that it has had on children and families in this state has been devastating. And if we can do anything in this building to put families and children back together, that's our goal and our objective with the Blue Ribbon Task Force. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you for all your hard work. When you said three of the four bills, I assume the fourth one would be the Senate Bill 842.
That's correct.
I will take another look at that bill. And it wasn't clear that they were that tightly joined. Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Back to 845. Just a question. Reading the language, it refers to says Centers for Family Success, and then it talks to as funding becomes available to the state or local commission for the centers. So I'm assuming you're looking at specific funding for these centers outside of the current funding that's in the state commission. And part of the question here is, does this reprioritize the mission of the state commission on children and families? Does it make a requirement on local commissions to change the way they're doing business or jeopardize their current funding streams?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, sorry about that. Pat Pittman, as I said, is here to talk for the State Commission, so I don't want to speak for them. I do know that they've been working on children of incarcerated parents as a goal for a number of years. That's been part of what they've been talking about. I think that the focus and the goals of the Centers for Family Success are very consistent with what local commissions do in their planning, looking at the breadth of services and trying to coordinate and integrate services. I think the concept is that as the state agencies work together, should there be funding sources identified within the budget, and that those resources would then go to the counties, who could then, like they do with Relief Nurseries and Healthy Start, be able to identify which organization is best positioned to provide that service and to make sure that the outcomes are in place and that the evidence-based practices are in place. That's the other piece, is that several years ago, when we were having some discussions about Relief Nurseries and whether or not the commission would, state commission would continue to support them, the state commission made a policy that unless something is destined to be statewide, they're not going to be involved with it. That was kind of an internal policy that they made, and you probably recall that in some of those conversations we had. So I've always made it a practice to include that language in any bill, just to make sure that they don't bump it out and say, well, this is a pilot project and we're not going to spend our time dealing with it. So
just follow up, and I understand it, and I know the context, obviously. I guess I just wanted to make sure on record that we aren't by moving in this direction diminishing efforts in established areas. For example, we have to, a county has to move in this direction, and so they're taking funds away from a relief. No. Just for the record.
No, there's no intent to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
But there is an intent that we recognize that individuals returning back to our community, there is an intent that we try to make them productive citizens rather than returning back to their old ways of doing things. That really is the intent.
And Senator, I understand that. I just don't want you messing with my relief nursery. So.
I don't think you want yours messed with either.
I don't want mine messed with either.
Thank you. Okay. Is your whole panel done now? Or
my panel is complete, unless you have additional questions.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out how to organize this. Caldago? Mr.
Calderazo.
Did you speak, Council?
No, I didn't, but I just agree with what they said.
Okay.
Blue Ribbon Committee also.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, thank you so much, and thank you for all your hard work and for all showing up today to give us the message in force. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, now I'm going to close the hearing on all three of these bills and open hearings on the individual bills to pick up people who signed up for maybe one but not the other. So we will start with a hearing on Senate Bill 843. Cindy Duran and Greg Olson are signed up.
That's why I
saw Olson just left.
You already did. Okay, I'll get this straight soon here. Cindy Duran, pick you up on this side.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cindy Duran with the Center for Family Success, and I am here also in support of Senate Bill 843 to require that DHS provide medical treatment. I was formerly incarcerated, came out of and completed Turning Point at Coffee Creek, which was the intensive drug treatment. My children were in foster care. When I came out, I was required to do aftercare through Bridgeway in Marion County, but I did not have medical insurance. So I did have to pay for that on my own, which I did, but I think there are a lot of persons coming out of incarceration who aren't able to do that. Some of those people are coming out from the AIP, Alternative Incarceration Program, where that is part of their, I think, parole. Which could be a violation if they aren't able to continue their aftercare treatment. So, therefore, I am in support of this.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much, and good luck with your continuing recovery. Okay. Is there anybody else who wanted to speak on 843? Close the hearing on Senate Bill 843. Open a hearing on Senate Bill 844. And I believe the only person we have signed up who has not already testified is Karen Wheeler.
Good Good afternoon. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Manager for the Addictions and Mental Health Division, DHS. I'm here today to provide testimony on Senate Bill 844, which establishes increased non-waivable unitary assessment fees in methamphetamine-related cases. The department's neutral on this bill as it's not included in the governor's budget. Additional resources to support addiction treatment would be welcome and needed. However, there are a few issues about this bill that I just want to bring to your attention. There's no target population identified to receive the services. The bill does not reference the county authority planning responsibilities for addictions and public safety services that could provide direction for use of these funds and meet identified gaps outlined in the local plan. There's no expectation that programs funded with the assessment fees be meet quality standards or that they be evidence-based. So I wanted to mention ORS 430, which outlines the requirements for local planning for addictions as well as mental health services. And ORS 430.420 specifically outlines a coordinated planning approach for juvenile justice-involved clients. This work was accomplished during the 2001 session with Senate Bill 914. Section 4.7 should be changed to read, "The clerk shall monthly transfer the portion of assessments collected as required by ORS 137.290 to C and D to the county for administration of substance abuse treatment programs as described in ORS 430.420. This language would ensure that funds generated as a result of increased unitary assessment fees would be used to support programs that meet minimum quality and performance standards as outlined by the Addictions and Mental Health Division, and also that they be evidence-based. This change would also promote a coordinated approach for use of these funds that is consistent with both the Mental Health and Addictions Plan as well as the Public Safety Plan that's completed by the local Public Safety Coordinating Council. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, so all your comments are directed to how the money is spent rather than the merits of collecting the money in the first place.
Sure, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, I don't have anybody else signed up for Senate Bill 844. Is there anybody else who wants to talk on that? Close the hearing on Senate Bill 844 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 845. And we will start by hearing from Sharon Darcy, Cindy Duran, and Ian Finch. Sharon, why don't you start?
Okay. Thank you very much for having us. I'm Chair Burdick and committee. My name is Sharon Darcy. I am the director of Pathfinders of Oregon. We are the contractor that for the last 15 years have done all of the cognitive programs in the prisons, and now we also do the parenting program in the prison. I'm one of the co-founders of the Children's Justice Alliance, and the current Center for Family Success in St. John's is a joint venture between the Children's Justice Alliance and Pathfinders of Oregon. I'm going to just give you a tiny history of how we got to this point to let you know that we really believe this bill is so important, and that a lot of work that's been done by the Department of Corrections, the Department of Human Services, nonprofits, county commissioners, sheriffs, has gotten us to the point where there's quite a bit of agreement that this is a very concrete way for us to serve families who have been impacted by the criminal justice system and their children, and we actually have some initial results to show that we're walking down the right road. So a lot of this work started through the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Social Learning Center probably before I even was involved, but by 2002 we were working down at the Oregon Social Learning Center in Eugene on a model looking at all of the research they've had for the last 40 years what they've found out about what causes dysfunction in families, antisocial behavior in children, et cetera. So Ben DeHaan, who was then the head of corrections, Claudia Black, who was also with the department, Mark Eddy of the Oregon Social Learning Center, myself, started working on a model that we planned to set up and demonstrate to everyone that this model would be the way to start breaking the intergenerational cycle of criminality. About the same time, the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Social Learning Center started working on the Parenting Inside Out parenting program, and I won't go into that. I think most of you are aware of it, but just to say that it's been very successful, and it's the only parenting program in the United States that was designed specifically to work with people who are involved in the criminal justice system, and many states now are coming to Oregon and wanting to access this really wonderful curriculum. By 2003, we decided that we really needed, the world needed yet another private nonprofit, and we formed the Children's Justice Alliance so we could advocate and we could educate about this really big problem, because no one had really looked at what was the impact on families and children as we as a nation went down the road of three strikes, you're out, Measure 11, et cetera, the get tough on crime. We didn't really realize what we were doing to children and families. You heard Commissioner Carlson talk about Marion County. In 2002, they did a survey and found that at least 20,000 inmates, or 20,000 children in Oregon had parents who were just in the prison system. We don't have the number, the exact number, if we want to look at jails, parole and probation, and prisons, but we estimate that's probably about 100,000 children in Oregon. Given, as you heard Commissioner Carlson say, these children are 6 to 7 times more likely to follow their parents into the criminal justice system, it's not probably a surprise why we are where we are today in Oregon. In 2004, there was quite a bit of work done between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections, and the Department of Human Services started funding the parenting program, as does the Department of Corrections, and by 2005, we decided we wanted to demonstrate the model, and we opened the Center for Family Success. Oh, I'm sorry, I was supposed to give these to you. Rather than take you through everything that has happened, I would just like to say we have been so successful, and based on Senator Cruz's questions about money and impacting other agencies, because we all know a lot of times your decisions have to be this or that. What I love about this model, and I've been in social services all my life, is this model is not as much about money as it is about education and about cooperation and building partnerships. And if you'd bear with me, I'd like to just tell you what the items in this packet are rather than talk about all of these things, and then you can go to the pieces that you want to go to. But this brochure will just outline the services at our center, what we know based on the relief nurseries. And by the way, I was the co-founder of the Children's Relief Nursery in Portland, and I wouldn't let anybody take away from a relief nursery to do anything if I could help it. But we know that every community has different resources and different needs, and so every center won't look exactly like this. But when we go into a community and start talking about centers, and we bring key champions in the community together, and they say, where's the money? We say, you're not ready yet. That's not the first question you ask. You ask, who are the players? How are we working together right now? How are we addressing these children's needs? And then you identify the holes, and then you go looking for money. So it very much to date has been an effort of bringing all the players together, including, just like the relief nurseries, private sector dollars, United Way dollars, Department of Labor dollars, any dollar we can find to meet a client's need. The second sheet after that is just an announcement that we are opening our first satellite center in Rockwood. If you're familiar with Portland, you know St. John's has been gentrified, and a lot of the clients that we need to serve are in Rockwood. The third piece is kind of the story of Ian's life, and you'll be hearing from him. The fourth piece is very exciting to us because it was a memo from Bruce Goldberg to all of his employees after he visited the center, basically asking them to look at this model and try to make Department of Human Services offices more like the Center for Family Success. The fifth piece is what the criteria would be to be a center. The next piece, and I'm going to pull that out and talk to you about it in a minute, is some initial results we have. The next piece is a heart tugger, and it's just a success story about one of our clients. And the piece after that is a description of the Parenting Inside Out curriculum, which, by the way, now is in all of the prisons. In the counties that it's now, because of the Department of Human Services and our contracts, it's in Multnomah, Marion, Malheur, Umatilla, and Douglas counties, and it soon will be in Lane, Lynn, and Washington counties. And we are having inquiries at all over the place about, can we use this curriculum? So the really great thing about that is people are getting this, something like this in prisons. They're going out to the communities, and they're also being put in complementary services. And that's something we've always had a problem with, is tying the services people get in prisons to the services they get in the communities. And the fifth piece is really exciting. But I won't again go into it. But this is the mechanism. It's called And How Are the Children? And it's an organizational tool for us to get the champions in different counties together, do a day-long training about the specific issues around children in the criminal justice system, whose parents are in the criminal justice system, and then have them look at what they have as a community, how they're working with these families, and organize around that. And to date, there are Marion County, Benton County, Malheur County, Umatilla County, East Multnomah County, Clackamas County, and Lane County have all had these trainings. After the training, they have all started their own Children of Incarcerated Parents project, and they're all going down the road of organizing and looking at the models and trying to create those in their own counties. So there is a real systematized way for us to get the information out and then give technical assistance to counties who want to provide these services. I think Cindy and Ian can give you the best example of what can be done when services like these are available. And I just want to tell you, if any of you ever are available to come to one of these trainings or to visit the center, as I said, I've been at DOC since 91 working, and not as a client, and I have never been so hopeful that we really are on to a systematized way of catching these people as they come out to our various counties and helping stabilize families and children and hopefully breaking the cycle. Because we all know who work in the prisons and in criminal justice, we know we're dealing with three generations now of in families that there is not another way at this point that they know other than being criminally involved, and we can't afford that as a state. So I thank you very much for caring about this issue and urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe we can hear from Ian.
Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ian Finch, and I'm a single parent of five children, ages 12, 11, 8, 6, and 2. I was up all last night with my baby. She was throwing up, so I'm a little slow. But I grew up with criminally justice-involved parents. Both my mom and my dad were drug addicts, so I was raised around drug addicts. I was doing methamphetamine with my mom when I was 13 years old. She'd send me to the laundromat doing methamphetamine. Saw them go in and out of jail, prison. So I kind of continued that cycle within my own family. And one morning I got raided. I got taken to jail, and my kids got taken by the state and put in protective custody. And I think that my aha moment of all this was when I was visiting my children at the DHS office, and I realized that my little kids would wrap their little fingers around my pants, and they didn't want me to go. They wanted to come home with me. And I realized that even though I let them down and wasn't there for them like I should have been, they still loved me. They still wanted to be with me. So after doing treatment and working with DHS to get my kids back, I got them back. And I had to think, what am I going to do different this time? How am I going to make this different? And what I discovered was, I need support. I need help. I need to talk to people that have been there. I need to ask for help when I needed it. Being a single father with five kids, you know, I couldn't do it alone without help from my community, from people who care about me, and that's where I did. I reached out for help, and I went. My children's mother is in Coffee Creek incarcerated because she didn't do treatment, and she kind of went down that other road that I could have went down too. So I'm parenting these children, and these children have an incarcerated parent. And what I decided was, you know, my kids are 6 to 7 times more likely to be involved in that criminal justice system. How do I stop it? What do I do to stop it? Well, not only I need support, but my kids need support. So I went to the Center for Family Success and said, hey, do you guys got anything that can help my kids? And they instantly got me connected with Big Brother, Big Sisters. So all my children have mentors that they go out with on a weekly basis. That's another person in their life providing support, showing them there's a good life out there. And they also got my kids involved in the Girl Scouts Beyond Bars program, so they can go to the prison and have a pro-social environment. And hopefully their mom can interact with them pro-socially. And because by the studies, it's shown that, you know, when the kids go, you know, visit the mom or the dad incarcerated, that, you know, that does make a difference. And hopefully when it's time for her to get out, and she can realize that, you know, her kids still love her too, and that she needs to be there and try something different. And so the center has provided the parenting classes that make it possible for me to raise five kids of different ages. And it's also given me support to not only there, but with other agencies that have been in my life to help support my children and I. And I've never asked for any handouts for us, my family. All I've asked was that my kids get the same chance as any other kids. I want my daughter to go to dance class like her friends. I want my son to play t-ball. And that's what I want for them. And I'm doing my part. I'm working. I'm trying to do things different this time. And 5 years later, this is where I'm at in front of you guys, you know, telling you my story. So thank you for letting me speak.
And you did a very nice job of it, and it's great you stepped up. I know it must be very hard. Thank you. Cindy.
Again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here today to speak on the Center for Family Success also. I wanted to speak first on our successes and our outcomes for 2005-2006. We had 73 parents graduate from the community version of Parenting Inside Out, which is a 12-week curriculum. It's also the shorter version of what is taught inside the institution. Out of the 73 graduates, 56 of them participated in a survey, and the results of that were 96% had no contact with the criminal justice system once they completed the parenting class. 48% were reunited with their children. 91% had consistent contact with their children. 54% were engaged in a recovery program. And also 11% were still in need of services, which included some more parenting, aftercare, housing, advocacy, or family violence, DV support. So those were very good outcomes for us, so we're excited about that. I'll speak briefly on my history. I was adopted by my grandparents, graduated from high school, was employed and immediately upon my graduation with the Department of Insurance and Finance. It was then that I began to use methamphetamine and continued to use for almost 13 years. I have 5 children. The oldest is 19. I have 10, 9, 6, and 5. And I used until I ended up at Coffee Creek, and I was sentenced to 34 months. When I went in, I was pregnant with my youngest child, and he was taken into foster care the following day, and then I went back to Coffee Creek. I had the opportunity to participate in these parenting classes, to go to a turning point for my drug treatment. I was there for, I think, 9 months, and I participated in Early Head Start. While I was there, I had the opportunity to meet Claudia Black, and that's how I connected with the Children's Justice Alliance and then speaking on panels and really coming out and, I think, learning as I spoke on the things of the pain and the suffering that I had caused for my children and my family. And so when I came out, I really wanted to continue doing that because there were things in my life that had happened and things that had happened to my children during my incarceration that weren't okay. And so I'm glad that I had that opportunity. I do have my children back with me. I waited a year after I was released to have them come with me because I needed stability, I needed to have housing and all those things. At the center today, I also went to college and graduated there. The day after I graduated, I started full-time at the Center for Family Success. And so now I'm able to do the things really that that I know I needed to have. And I try not to live in the past of what I've done or what could have been. The one thing that I do ask is, what if when I had been released from Marion County Jail on the third or fourth time, what if somebody had went to Marion County with a card that said Center for Family Success? If that had been available, would I have ended up at Coffee Creek? I don't think I would have ended up at Coffee Creek. And that's what we do now. I'm able to go to Inverness Jail and make a release plan before they release. This is where you're housing. You're going to go for housing. This is how long you have to wait for treatment. And those things are so important because some of these women and even the men in there don't have anything to go to once they go out. And that's where they just come out and do the same thing over again with all the intentions of going home to their children. But they just don't make it there. And so it just starts that process over again. I'm an advocate at the center, which means I work with the moms and dads. Some of them may not be parents, attending their DHS hearings if they're going towards termination, reunification, visitation, whatever the plan may be, to be there to support them through that whole process, because that's usually where they get stuck and give up and go right back to what they know. In which is, you know, using meth or whatever addiction that they have, criminality. We also are in close contact with parole and probation. Whatever it is that is on their case plan is usually they're working with the Family Services Unit, so we'll work with parole and probation, DHS, and the center to do the same case plan so that they're not going 12 different places. Fortunately, at the center, we have a lot of the services that they're being required to participate in, and they can come there, do parenting, get the coach parenting time, work with our employment specialists. Either Ian and I will work on them as far as advocacy or doing referrals to other agencies that we don't have in the building. We have a DHS self-sufficiency worker in the building who helps them with food stamps or medical, those types of things. One of the biggest things that we do is the advocacy, not just for, we don't just advocate for them, but we teach them to advocate for themselves, because that is one of the big the big things is that authority has always been an issue for us, obviously, or we wouldn't have ended up in prison or jail if we went by the rules. So just being able to show them how to advocate for themselves and giving them examples of, because we are in recovery and we have been there, this is what works for us, and this is what we did or who we talked to in order to get things changed, because it is a difficult process. You know, once you're sentenced and you have convictions on your record, that doesn't, your sentence doesn't end just because you leave Coffee Creek. You still have your, I mean, like I see it for myself, I have a life sentence on housing. I was convicted of manufacturing and delivering. I can't just go out and get whatever housing is available. So I have to advocate for myself in different ways than most people would regularly do that.
And Cindy, we're going to have to wrap this up a little bit.
Okay. So basically that's what we do at the center. So, I mean, it's a great opportunity for them. And right now there's just, I think, just us in St. John's. So we travel to Salem, Washington County, Clackamas County, wherever we're needed. So
great. Sounds like a great program. Yeah. Great employees.
Yeah.
Questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, our last witness is Pat Pittman.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, I am Pat Pittman with the State Commission on Children and Families, mentioned in Senate Bill 845. Just have a brief statement to make for you in the interest of time as well. We have no position on this bill, although we support the concept. We agree that Family Success Center model is an excellent way to serve families, especially the way it provides a comprehensive array of services. These centers are similar to family centers already in State Commission statute. So we have some experience in this area, although these particular centers are focused on children of incarcerated parents. What you have in front of you is a handout describing an initiative that has been developed or is under development with the Partners for Children and Families, a team of state and local partners. And that initiative is another variation on a center model or a menu of services that would be available to families. In the process of developing this concept, we toured the Center for Family Success up in St. John's, and we have heard presentations on Accessing Success, a program through the Eugene Relief Nursery. We explored those models because of their successes in providing or linking to an individually designed array of services needed by the family. The concept of providing a menu of services individually tailored to the needs of families makes sense to us. And we agree that centers such as these could stop the flow of families moving into the child welfare system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions from the committee? Council?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ms. Pittman, is there anything in your statute right now that would prevent you from supporting the Centers for Family Success?
Nothing to prevent us from supporting that. We have the phrase, based on available funding,
mm-hmm.
Applies to both this bill and family centers that have been funded through our system before and no longer are. So sustainability is an issue for us. Okay. But nothing prevents us from getting that work done at this point in time except capacity and funding.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up. All right. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 845, and we are adjourned.